John Rourke sipped at a cup of coffee, his eyes focused beyond the rim of the cup on the computer animation of the anticipated effects of the volcanic eruption. The video screen on which it was displayed dominated the far wall of the conference room, its proportions as large as the motion picture screens of the 20th century. Watching this animated holocaust brought back bitter memories of watching video screens much smaller from within the confines of the retreat more than 625 years ago, when the ionized atmosphere reacted to the heating of the sun and the skies caught fire in what came to be called the Great Conflagration. If that was a disaster of truly biblical proportions, this would be near to it in scope, although more localized. John Rourke had never been one to just sit around and wait for the inevitable. Perhaps fate could not be conquered, or perhaps it could, but fate could be contested at least. Annie's seemingly naive question was provocative. In theory, at least, what Dr. Rolvag said about tapping into the arterial flow of the volcano was fraught with promise. The technology available for such an attempt might not be equal, however, to the task. Its logic was inescapable. Rather than let the volcanic matter pour out violently through one hole, relieve that pressure so that the material would instead dissipate through a series of holes, and the volcanic matter would waste itself on the seafloor. Something Rolvag hadn't mentioned bothered John Rourke as well. Would this eruption, unprecedented in recorded history, be so massively violent that it would in some manner or other affect the geothermal vent from which both Midwake and the former Soviet underwater complex, now a Russian-American manufacturing facility, derived electrical power? Without electrical power in massive kilowattage, the domed facilities would not be able to maintain the required air pressure and would have to be evacuated. Midwake was the seat of the United States government, still the major repository for American culture. Thousands of persons would have to be gotten to safety. If there was insufficient time for that, or an inadequate number of vessels, thousands of persons would instead suffocate in their own waste air, while those few who might still cling to life would be crushed as the sea finally collapsed the domed cities. Dr. Thornton Rolvag appeared without warning at Rourke's elbow.
You move quietly, Doctor.
Thank you, Doctor. A pleasure to meet the man my ancestor thought so highly of.
A pleasure to meet Bjorn Rolvag's spiritual descendant. It's hard to imagine Rolvag, however, without a staff in his hands or a great dog at his heels.
I have several dogs. Raised them, as a matter of fact. One is even named Hrothgar. Looks a great deal like the original Hrothgar, really, as far as I can tell from photographs. You'll have to meet him and see for yourself. And my Hrothgar carries a little of the original Hrothgar's blood. As to the staff, well, I'm afraid I'm not much of a weapons man, although, like almost everyone, I own a few firearms, and I've learned how to use them with at least a modicum of skill.
Your predictions, Doctor. Do they take into account the fate of the geothermal vent from which Midwake derives its power?
They're hardly predictions in the crystal ball sense, of course. They're probabilities based on the interpretation of identifiable available data. There is that possibility concerning Midwake, obviously. We're working on a computer model even now concerning that, so that we can try to arrive at some meaningful projections relating to the geothermal vent. For the moment, it's a wait-and-see situation. I liked your daughter's question. On the surface, it sounded a bit...
naive? Well, on the surface, one might be tempted to think so, yes. But Annie isn't the sort of person to let grass grow under her feet waiting around helplessly for the inevitable. And she provoked an intriguing response. Now, you'll have to agree, Dr. Rolvag.
You know weapons and explosives far better than I. Do you think it could work, Dr. Rourke? I mean, utilizing some artificial means by which the pressure within the volcano can be relieved?
Both the United States and New Germany have new conventional explosives, more powerful than anything which existed in my time. I think the possibility bears serious investigation. Serious and rather rapid investigation, actually. You might save an incalculable number of lives and prevent terrible devastation.
Would you help me talk with the Navy?
Yes, certainly. Let's do it right now.
In the far corner, nearer to the screen, he saw Admiral Hayes. Immediately, Rourke began walking with Rolvag toward the woman. The computer animation had reached the part where the side of the mountain collapsed and immense quantities of molten rock spilled forth. The video presentation was fascinating, but John Rourke didn't want to see life imitate art. When the telephone rang, Emma Shaw had been doing something she considered inherently foolish, putting her hair into ultrasound rollers. When she picked up the receiver, she had only one roller left to go. Curls and waves of the natural kind originated within the molecular structure of the hair follicles themselves. When curls were made artificially, the molecular structure was bent. In centuries gone by, chemicals and/or heat were the medium for bending the hair. By accident, when ultrasound showers were designed for field use in arid climates, northern Australia, the Gulf Coast fringe of North American Eden, etc., it was discovered that hair follicles were affected. Over the last 15 years, ultrasound rollers had replaced almost every other means of curling one's hair. The telephone call from the officer of the day for the unit to which she was temporarily assigned had told her that all leaves were canceled and she should report with all speed to unit headquarters at Pearl. She hung up, finished putting in the last roller, and threw together her gear out of the house in under 8 minutes. Ultrasound rollers did their work in less than 15 minutes, so when she was 10 minutes away from Pearl, on the straightaway where she figured she could get away with it, she kept one hand on the wheel and freed her hair of the rollers with the other. Without brushing it out, she looked in the rearview mirror and was reminded of Medusa. But she managed to brush her hair reasonably well before turning into the access road to the main gate. Past the security checkpoints, she went immediately to her fighter wing. There was traffic everywhere, on the ground and in the air. For the last several minutes of the drive, she was able to observe the huge C-6000 skyjumpers taking off, not roaring into the upper atmosphere on their enormous jet boosters for intercontinental atmospheric insertion jumps, but flying low and slow, almost afterburnering it by comparison to their usual thrust. Island hopping? She wondered. Shore Patrol was guarding the entrance to Wing HQ, and even though she had her ID badge clipped onto the left breast pocket flap of her jumpsuit, and the two guys at the door, with energy rifles, knew her by sight, it was still necessary to have a more positive ID. She did the palm print thing with the panel on the door. That palm and fingerprints could be prosthetically altered these days hadn't filtered down to Navy security yet, and was at last given access. For an officer of Kroenberg's rank to participate in a field exercise was, of course, sheer madness, but it was necessary, and his English, when he was cautious, could be accent-free. So was the English of the men with him. It was one of the reasons they were chosen for the operation. There was a certain thrill in the blood on a mission such as this, almost like a sexual release when it was over. Kroenberg had plenty of sex when he wanted it, but somehow commando work was even more satisfying. Perhaps its edge of death was the reason. Several of the others were already on base, Kroenberg and a fellow named Rolf. A good young man, and particularly so with any sort of edged weapon, were driving together. Rolf showed his ID at the main gate, as did Kroenberg, and without further ado, they were inside Pearl Harbor, the greatest base of military power of the United States. It was that easy. Hopefully, this simplicity would be the hallmark of the mission itself to rescue young Martin. Ed had a family, wife, kids, but Tim Shaw, although he had a son and a daughter, had no home responsibilities. But he did have his work. With the coming disaster, the Nazi commando team responsible for the attack on Sebastian's Reef Country Day School would be in a better position to wreak havoc than they could ever have expected. So it was more important than ever to stop them. Yuri hadn't been at the apartment when Tim Shaw had gone there earlier with Annie Rubenstein. What a neat girl, he thought. Smiling, just thinking about her. She had spunk, just like Emma did, living proof that someone could have balls without having testicles. His hat low over his eyes, his coffee steaming the windshield of the unmarked cruiser, Shaw sat behind the wheel and watched the building while he ate his dinner. Indigestion and divorce were the two chronic problems of the police officer. He'd never experienced divorce, his wife dying as the result of a freak accident. Indigestion, on the other hand, was inseparable from the territory. But the cheeseburgers at Bingo's were usually at least edible, sometimes pretty good. This, his second, but it was dinner, was a pretty good one. Half devoured, he put it aside and grabbed a few French fries, munching on them as he watched for Yuri to either enter or leave. Most likely, Yuri was not home. No lights in his windows, no car in his parking slot. It was possible that Yuri'd picked up word on the street that the cops were after him and knew where to find him, hence might never come back here. But that wasn't likely. The kids who'd talked up Yuri's address were scared, maybe just scared enough not to try crossing the cop who could have put them away. Anyway, it was too early to give up and go home. A good dinner enabled a man to do his best thinking. Rather than the matter at hand, Yuri would take care of himself, either showing up or not, Tim Shaw considered the obvious look in his daughter Emma's eyes when she looked at John Rourke. Ever since she'd been old enough, he'd wanted her to fall in love with somebody, get married, raise children, do all the natural and normal things. If she was in love with John Rourke, aside from the fact that Dr. Rourke was a larger-than-life living legend born more than 6 centuries ago, with children Emma's age and a wife who was neither dead nor alive, as best Tim Shaw could make of it, Rourke would be a bad choice on other grounds. According to what his son and Emma's brother Ed said, Dr. John Thomas Rourke was the best man he'd ever seen in combat. And the times that were coming, war with Eden, would demand a great deal from a man like that. Assuming that everything else was somehow taken care of, what would Emma do with the guy she loved off all over the globe fighting and her at home worrying? Tim Shaw didn't have any answers, and he wondered if he even had the right questions. Emma going head over heels for John Rourke somehow just seemed like a no-win proposition for her, something which would only bring her unhappiness. Like every father from the beginning of time, Tim Shaw imagined, he wanted his daughter to have a life full of happiness, not sorrow. And Dr. Rourke, however neat a guy he was, and Rourke was all of that and more, was also trouble. Finished with his pie, as Tim Shaw glanced across the street again, he saw a car pulling up. And Shaw recognized this car, a red and white 1957 Chevrolet dripping with gleaming chrome, as readily as he recognized the guns of the Rourke family. There was a woman behind the wheel of the Chevy. Yuri sat in the front passenger seat. As Shaw's own father would have put it, Yuri and the woman began to swap spit there in the front seat. Shaw's mind raced. When was the best time to grab Yuri? Now? When Yuri exited the Chevy? When Yuri went up to his place? Tim Shaw decided. The street had more possibilities. Shaw grabbed a radio out of the niche in the dashboard and dropped it into the left outside pocket of his raincoat. His car was parked almost directly opposite the Chevy. The brim of his fedora was still low over his eyes. Tim Shaw started crossing the street, looking both ways, but not just for traffic. It was always possible Yuri was setting him up, but doubtful. Shaw's course was a diagonal. By the time he was on the other side of the street, he was behind the Chevy. He took the curb, walked up from behind the Chevy, and as he approached the passenger side, the window was down, he did two things. He glanced into the back seat to make sure it wasn't a setup for him, and he snatched the .45 from his trouser waistband. His left hand went to the door handle, and Shaw slipped in just behind Yuri, thumbing the .45's hammer back to full stand as he laid the muzzle behind Yuri's right ear.
Hey, don't let me stop yous.
You motherfucker!
Shut your face, you worthless sack of shit!
Joey! Who is this?
Tim Shaw, ma'am. I'm a police officer, so rest easy.
You ain't got no fucking warrant, you...
I need a warrant to arrest you, Yuri, but I can kill you without a fucking warrant. What's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this, kid?
It's my car!
And a gorgeous car it is, babe. Hey, you don't mind if Yuri and I finish our business outside, huh? I mean, after all, you wouldn't want blood all over your upholstery.
Shaw tapped Yuri with the muzzle of the .45.
Tell the young lady goodnight, dirtbag. Tell her!
Good night.
Tell her you had a nice time.
I had a nice time.
There you go. Stick with me, Yuri, and you'll be a killer with the broads. No offense.
Huh. I bet you he could learn a lot from you.
You'd be surprised, miss.
Shaw opened the door, got out, and opened Yuri's door, yanking him out of the car.
Good night!
Yeah, fuck you!
You're gonna pay, man!
No, I don't like paying for information. You're gonna give it to me for free, and then maybe, just maybe, I won't croak you. Go rabbing it on me, and you're whacked.
What you want, man?
Nazis. The mothers that hit the Sebastian's Reef Country Day School today.
I don't know nothing about no fucking Nazis, man.
Walk.
Where are you taking me, man?
Walking's good for you, Yuri. And after a good walk, there's nothing more relaxing than lying down for a good rest.
What?
They reached the corner and Shaw stopped Yuri.
Time to lie down.
What?
Down. Flat on your face. In the street. Now. Pass me through to the fire department.
The fire department? What the?
Shut up!
What you want the damn fire department for, man?
Relax, Yuri. Do I look like the kind of guy who's gonna set you on fire?
This is Commander Irving.
Yeah, Commander, this is Tim Shaw, Honolulu Tech. Look, for this operation I got going down here, I need a fire truck, see?
He gave Commander Irving the address.
I need a truck to come right around the corner as fast as it can, coming down on Brixton Street, make that turn, plenty of speed, plenty of sirens. You guys do that?
Yeah, I need authorization, Mr. Shaw.
It's Inspector, and I run the friggin' TAC team. That enough?
Yeah, well, yeah, I, gas.
All right, faster guys can make that turn, the better.
I'll dispatch the trucks right away.
Now, I'll see before they get here.
2 minutes or a little over.
That's perfect. Consider yourself owed one, Commander.
Right.
You hear that, Yuri?
What the hell do you need some damn fire truck?
I don't need a fire truck. Any truck will do. See, you're gonna keep lying there in the street. And when the fire truck turns a corner, a buddy of mine used to call them drunken painters because they're always running around and hauling ladders. Anyway, when the fire truck turns a corner, they're gonna run right over you, Yuri. Tragic, huh?
Yuri started to get up.
You're crazy, man!
Well, to tell you the truth, Yuri, the thing at the school really upset me, you know? All those kids and everything, I gotta take it out on somebody. If I had the Nazis that did it, I'd kill them, but all I got's you.
Let me up, man. I don't know shit.
Sure you do, Yuri. It's that brown stuff that's gonna be filling your pants soon as you hear the first tire truck coming around the corner. Probably gonna be a hook and ladder, a real big long ones with those, axles and those big truck tires, you know?
I don't know no Nazi, Shaw.
Golly, what a shame. And I'd probably feel real guilty after all those trucks grinding you into the pavement just thinking about that.
Then let me up.
Get up and I shoot you. You'd be just as dead either way.
Man, I don't know no fucking Nazis.
I don't really care what the Nazi sex life is like, Yuri. I just want to know where to find them.
Okay. They got this place. It's at the waterfront on that.
Wow, I'm gonna feel real bad. I go down to the waterfront, don't find him, and you run over by all those trucks and everything?
I ain't lying. It's the damn truth, man. I don't know where the hell them Nazis is, man.
As Shaw figured the time from the sound, the first fire truck would be coming around the corner in about 45 seconds.
Yuri, look, I'll wait on the curb, huh?
Yuri visibly filled his pants.
Where are they, Yuri? And if it doesn't sound like the truth, you've got the choice of a bullet or a fire truck.
Staying with Stroud, over in an immigrant village in the condo Stroud owns. There's 12 of them, and they got a special assignment. Ain't tied with none of the other commando groups. All they do is terrorist shit, man. They got guns and explosives and all that good shit. Heavy hitters, the big building on the corner across from the fish markets. I don't know the address, man. Let me up.
There wasn't time for Shaw to let Yuri get to his feet. At the far edge left of Shaw's peripheral vision, there was a blur of motion, a streak of red. Shaw was already jumping from the curb, grabbing Yuri by the shirt collar and dragging him back. The first fire truck rounded the corner almost in the same instant, its slipstream ripping the black fedora from Tim Shaw's head.
He's so fit.
Tim Shaw shook him loose. Yuri stayed there, on his knees, eyes turned up toward Tim Shaw's face. Shaw held the muzzle of the .45 inches from Yuri's right eye. Despite the evening's breeze, the smell from what Yuri had done to himself was almost overpowering.
Go and sin no more, or next time you die.
Tim Shaw upped the safety on the .45 and walked the few paving squares to where his hat had landed and picked it up.
I'm sorry I messed things up with you and the babe.
It was ultra-modern here. There were no bars, but if he attempted to pass through the ordinary doorway leading from his cell, it was more like a very small apartment, he would be stopped. There was a powerful electrical field there that would shock, stun, or kill, depending on how one interacted with it. A touch, a shock. A partial body contact, a stun. If he threw himself through the field, the voltage would likely stop his heart permanently. The power of the field was demonstrated to Martin Zimmer when he was locked in. An old tennis ball was used. After passing through the plasma energy field, it was half disintegrated. What remained of it blackened, crisped. Martin Zimmer was adequately convinced. He stayed where he was put. Since he was a VIP, the accommodations, however Spartan, had some amenities. There were books. He hated reading. There was radio. He found music uninteresting. And there was television. The news bored him, and he hated most of what was broadcast, particularly the westerns, which seemed to dominate dramatic programming. He played solitaire and watched soap operas throughout the day. After dinner, filling but bland, he continued playing solitaire and paid half-hearted attention to a documentary on the life of Nathaniel Darkwood, scientist and explorer, one of the founders of Midwake. Martin Zimmer cared not a whit for Darkwood from a biographical standpoint, but the underwater photography was diverting enough. When it came to the part about how, through the efforts of Darkwood and others, Midwake, the underwater scientific research station, became Midwake the city-state, surviving the Holocaust of the surface, Martin Zimmer, despite his dislike of music, turned to MTV. As far as he was concerned, it would have been better if Midwake had perished on the night of the war. There would have been no United States, no Pearl Harbor Naval Base, no jail cell in which to be incarcerated. Martin Zimmer suspended his game of solitaire. He couldn't find a red nine without prying beneath the rows of face-down cards, and that took concentration in order to do it artfully. And his favorite group was on television with their latest video, Gimme Head and the BJs doing Deep Penetration. He read all the fanzines from New Germany, the United States, and Australia. Books were a waste of time, and he knew everything there was to know about Gimme Head and the BJs. He'd been planning to have them do a private performance at Eden City before all this with the Rourke family had come up. And someday, he'd still have them. This particular video was filmed inside an atmospheric insertion jet specially rigged out with all the seats removed. So when the jet intentionally went to zero gravity, that was unnecessary in atmospheric insertions, of course, they could all roll around and play their guitars at the same time. And the girls with them in this video were so gorgeous looking that Martin Zimmer got an erection just looking at them and fantasizing himself with Gimme Head and the BJs, and the girls weightless and flying naked. When the video was over, he resumed searching for his red nine. The radio transceiver was exceedingly artful. It was hidden inside his left cheek, where a wisdom tooth would have been if he'd had one. It slipped in and out easily. Natural acids within his saliva powered the battery. Voice quality for the receiver was always poor, however, since much of the actual speech occurred in combination with tongue, teeth, and lips. But when one whispered carefully, the transmitted speech was intelligible. Sound, when receiving, was transmitted along the jawbone directly to the inner ear. Built into the system were compensators which would prevent a sudden high-decibel incoming noise from stunning the ear. The members of the commando team were in place, some by the guard station at the helipad serving the Fleet Admiral's base headquarters, others near the brig, still others near the motor pool synth fuel dump located on the far side of the base. His driver, young Rolf, beside him, Kroenberg, his naval commander's dress white sparkling, approached the two fatigue-clad Marines who stood guard at the doorway to the Pearl Harbor brig. They saluted. Kroenberg returned the salute and started for the doorway.
Begging the commander's pardon, sir, but I'll have to ask for a palm print check, sir.
Kroenberg had not expected this, because it was not usual base security procedure, nor had this practice been instituted as little as 2 hours ago. Kroenberg started to move his right hand toward the palm print identifier panel, set like a plaque beside the doorway. The young Marine Lance Corporal stepped back. Even though Gruppenführer Kroenberg had not anticipated this, he had planned ahead for the unexpected. The concept of a weapon carried up a sleeve of a garment was nothing new, nor was the principle of mechanically assisting the retrieval of such a weapon. The device Kroenberg wore, in order to guard against both such contingencies, required two rather irregular movements to be performed in sequence. As he moved his right arm now, as if to touch his hand to the panel, Kroenberg cocked his right wrist back to maximum extension, thus performing the first motion and moving his hand out of range. Kroenberg wheeled toward the nearer of the two Marines, rotating his arm downward and outward, then up and in. At the same instant, Kroenberg heard the sound of Rolf's knife ripping fabric and flesh, and the second Marine started to fold. Kroenberg shoved the body through the doorway and drew his pistol. Then Kroenberg stepped through the doorway after the dead man. As expected, there were no guards in the antechamber between the exterior and interior doors. Kroenberg shoved his dead man into the nearest corner, relieving the body of its energy rifle. Rolf had already done the same. One of them on either side of the interior doorway, Rolf turned the knob. As expected, it opened. There were two guards on the other side.
We are inside. All is well. Hurry!
The others posted near the brig would follow them in, but Kroenberg and Rolf did not wait, crisscrossing as they passed through the doorway, momentarily taking cover behind the two desks. As expected, there was no resistance. They started down the corridor toward the VIP cell block where Martin Zimmer was housed. Ordinary solitaire was too easy, and after several hours of playing in, Martin Zimmer tired. He wasn't ready for a nap, and nothing else of interest presented itself. He took up the cards again and shuffled them well, then dealt 25 cards face down. He set the remaining 27 aside, then picked up the 25. Fanning these out in his left hand, he started picking cards, deciding to try to form full houses first, then work back from that. The game was called by various names. His father, Dietrich Zimmer, who had taught it to him, had said, but most commonly, poker solitaire. The object, statistically almost impossible and in actuality difficult to perform, was to make five pat hands in poker. Straights, flushes, straight flushes, full houses. When he was in practice, which he was not, Martin Zimmer could do it about 1 in 10 times. Getting four pat hands was almost absurdly simple, but then breaking up those hands and reforming them in order to produce a total of five was the frustratingly difficult part. As he started building a diamond flush, the plasma energy shield could be heard to crackle on the other side of the door. Martin looked at his digital wristwatch. It was too early for the evening security check, and he'd already had dinner. Martin Zimmer dropped his cards to the floor and stood up.
Kronberg!
Martin!
We have come to rescue you from these enemies who wrongfully imprison you.
There was a detailed physical profile of each of the prisoners in the Pearl Harbor brig, and the closest physical match to young Martin happened to be a black man, with the first name of Adolf. The whole idea appealed to Kronberg's dark sense of humor. To get Martin out of the brig without a major battle erupting the moment someone happened to spot him, they would disguise him as this black man who was serving time in the brig for running a dice game. A digitized, photographic representation of Adolf Langley was obtained and enhanced into three-dimensional perspective, then a life mask prosthesis constructed, as well as hand coverings. Martin Zimmer protested, of course.
This is the only way to get you free, Martin. I know it is a sacrifice to disguise yourself as this person, but you make this sacrifice for the greater glory of National Socialism. It is the lot of the hero to give of himself.
That last remark apparently convinced Martin. With Rolf and two others helping, Kronberg elected to watch the corridor rather than help dress Martin. Martin Zimmer was ready to travel in 7 minutes, except for one detail. As they brought Martin to the door, Kronberg reached into the case from which the clothing had been taken and produced the restraints.
I am afraid you will have to wear these, Martin, in order that this should look convincing.
The things I do for my people.
From Kronberg's detailed analysis of Martin Zimmer over the years, including sexual habits, he doubted seriously that Martin was anything but excited by the prospect of being in chains. The belly chain was locked at the back, then Martin's wrists put into the cuffs, holding his hands at waist level. Kronberg wanted to say something, but didn't. Instead, he directed Rolf with a nod to lead Martin away. As the last man exited Martin's cell, Kronberg reactivated the plasma barrier. Three cars had already pulled up behind the fish market. Tim and Ed Shaw sat in the car, waiting.
The three cars behind the condos are in position. The only way they'll get out of there is if they can fly.
Don't be too cocky.
Tim Shaw turned away from staring at the condos and looked at the 12 men.
All right. It's the kind of a funny operation. We don't have a warrant, don't have probable cause beyond an informer's tip. And my ass will be in a sling if anybody knew how I got it. And the idea isn't so much to arrest these bastards as to stop them. If we can take them alive, terrific. We'll get good information out of them, but if it's a choice between killing the motherfuckers and letting one of them get away, we kill. Any questions?
Ed would run things tactically, because he was better at it.
Give him the word, Eddie.
Ed gave the word. After attacking the Sebastian's Reef Country Day School, the plan was to drive to the opposite end of Honolulu and carry out a similar operation against one of the city of Honolulu's largest public schools, where children from the immigrant community and the children of other of the island's poorer elements attended. Because of the short span of time between reaching the island and pulling the first raid, however, there had not been sufficient opportunity to prepare the required number of explosive charges. Hence, the container which housed more than 75% of the team's detonators was brought along. For safety, the explosives were kept in one van and the detonators in the other. The van which was intercepted was the one carrying the detonators. The second assault was scrubbed, and now Wilhelm Doring faced a critical shortage of proper detonators. While he mentally kicked himself for the price of his haste, Wilhelm Doring's eyes never left Marie as she spoke with the old woman at the lunch counter. The other six men who had accompanied them were watching the street. Two at either end of the block on the same side as the restaurant. The transceiver in Doring's mouth would alert him should there be any potential trouble. At last, Marie's seemingly interminable conversation with the old woman ended, and she, Marie Dreisling, started back toward the doorway where Doring stood, waiting.
Well?
Willie, she...
Do we have the detonators or not?
Her husband didn't tell her. He said he would be late and we should wait here for him.
The girl and I have to wait here. Keep your positions. I will be in radio contact as necessary. Doring out.
She suggested we come and sit at the lunch counter, Willie. She'll give us free food and coffee.
He could have strangled Marie for her complacency concerning the detonator shortage and her enthusiasm over the offer of coffee and food.
That sounds pleasant enough.
He took her elbow and started toward the counter with her, careful that the tips of his fingers didn't crush her arm. It was a cardinal rule of any clandestine operation that meeting times were to be met exactly, neither early nor late. If a predetermined appointment could not be kept, the meeting was scrubbed. But because he needed the detonators, Wilhelm Doring would wait. Fleet Admiral Wilma Hayes' helicopter was the finest and fastest of those made in the United States, equal to anything found flying for Eden City. The helicopter's top Condition 1 speed was 500 miles per hour, and it was nearly as maneuverable as a fighter aircraft, could outrun any helicopter gunship in the arsenal of any of the world's powers. It was precisely because of its excellence that Gruppenführer Kroenberg had included the machine in his escape plans. Rolf, driving the sedan, was as good with a helicopter as he was with a knife. He had flown Eden's most comparable machines, almost as fast, but vastly less maneuverable, and was completely versed in the literature of the Laemmlir 12A. All that was necessary was to neutralize the Marine Corps personnel guarding the Admiral's helicopter, then get it airborne and away. For the former task, standard procedures would suffice. Security measures were rarely able to frustrate the intentions of those who were truly bold, and for the latter, there was the planned diversionary action at the motor pool fuel dump. Had Kroenberg selected the synth fuel storage area, which served Pearl Harbor's fighters and gunship response groups, there would have been a substantially greater guard force with which the men he had detailed to the operation would be required to deal. Rolf turned the sedan into the side drive, running parallel to the Admiral's headquarters complex.
Can't we just drive off?
If we drive, Martin, the moment your escape is detected, every helicopter, every car, every remote in the area will be watching for us. The chances would be substantial that we would be captured, you recaptured. And we must get off the island. Were we to evade initial response efforts, every place of exit from the island would be sealed, coastal patrols increased, etc. It would be necessary for us to swim out to a rendezvous with a vessel. Possibilities for success would be doubtful at best, and the very act would be fraught with peril to you. But by stealing the Admiral's helicopter, we not only escape the base in an aircraft which will be almost impossible to catch, but we escape the island as well. By the time fighters are scrambled in pursuit of us, we will have arrived at our destination. The helicopter will be set on autopilot and dispatched over the open sea. As the helicopter is intercepted, it will be destroyed by us. Therefore, there will be some resultant confusion as to whether or not you lived or died. That is to our advantage.
I cannot wait, my faithful Gruppenführer, to be rid of this disguise.
I assure you, Martin, that soon all of your vicissitudes will be at an end. Forgive me while I confer with the personnel waiting to institute the needed diversion.
The sedan was fewer than 100 meters from the helicopter and the guards surrounding it.
This is Rescue Leader. We approach our objective, Beta. Initiate action against your objective, then commence escape sequence. Out.
50 meters now, the sedan slowing. Kroenberg had already reloaded the 7.65mm sleeve pistol. Thorn Rolvag's wife, Ellie, fed both Rolvag and Betty Gilder a hastily prepared late supper of spaghetti with meat sauce, garlic bread, and red wine. The children, Daniel and Trixie, were already fed, off in the nearby recreation room, watching their favorite interactive television program. Ellie picked at her food. Waiting to eat with her husband, as had been her custom ever since they were engaged, always seemed to destroy her appetite. And she was as pretty as ever, Rolvag thought, just looking at her.
So you really have to go up there tonight?
I tried talking your stubborn husband out of it, but it's that old Viking stock, I guess. Makes him bullheaded.
Not that I want to, but Dr. Rourke took me over to see all this Navy brass, and I told them about Betty's and my diversion theory, and well...
I had nothing to do with it. You're the brains of the operation. All I said was that I thought the diversion theory was brilliant, that it would indeed be possible to redirect lava flow and reduce the force of the actual eruption.
If Kilauea is about to erupt, Thorne, you don't have to be up there. You can monitor everything.
No. See, I need pressure readings, sweetheart. Pressure readings have to be taken in situ. It's just like taking somebody's blood pressure. You can't do it without touching the arm.
You can get an accurate blood pressure reading by other means than putting a cuff on somebody.
Well, I can't test vent pressure without being there. There's a chopper taking me up. They drop me off and pick me up a couple of hours later. And I've already called my data back, and it's crunching through the computer. Simple.
He's not going alone. Carl Bremen, the graduate student, he's going to go along.
What about all these Nazi terrorists, Thorne? I don't like the idea of you being God knows where with all of these...
There's no reason in the world why any Nazi terrorist would be on a volcano. I've got constant radio contact ability, and I carry a pistol.
Take your other gun.
The shotgun's too cumbersome to lug around when I've got the monitoring equipment.
Then the other one, the one that looks like a submachine gun but isn't.
The SP-89? Fine, I'll take that. And Carl carries a gun, too.
I don't know much about guns, but I know graduate students can't afford good ones.
Thorne Rolvag didn't know what kind of gun Carl carried, but with any luck, he wouldn't have the occasion to have to find out, either. Thorne Rolvag could hear Hrothgar and some of the other dogs barking from the kennels. But animals could often sense things men could not, sense impending earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, other natural disasters, even storms. Rolvag took a last sip from his wine, not finishing the contents of the glass. Tonight he would have to be very clear-headed. And he tried to ignore the barking of the dogs, because he knew what caused it. The walkway between the buildings was narrow, as if space were at too great a premium to bother with convenience. But casual observation from above would be more difficult, so Tim Shaw didn't complain about it. Instead, along with three of the tack team men, he made his way along the walkway, staying as close as they could to the building wall to further frustrate any chances of being detected. When at last they reached the rear of the building, Shaw signaled a halt.
Okay, we're at the back. Eddie, remind your guys one more time, we got maybe 12 badasses in there, so be cool.
Using infrared sensing from a video drone flyby, he'd had a buddy in narcotics call it in. They were able to tell from body heat signature registers that only the third floor had any apartments with more than three people in them. It stood to reason that the Nazis would stay together, Shaw hoped. At the near side of the third floor, the drone gave a reading in excess of three persons. Beyond that, because of the materials used in the building, it was impossible to get a precise figure. There could have been 10 people in the apartment. And of course, the apartment could have been occupied by a family of four. In that case, back to square one. But Shaw didn't think so. Yet, because of the chance that there weren't any bad guys in the apartment at all, it wouldn't be practical to break in and start shooting. A check of the package boxes in the lobby showed nobody at all living on the third floor. That was suspicious in itself, since housing in this part of town was hard to come by. And this character Stroud, who owned the building, probably wanted to keep it rented so he could make money. But maybe Stroud made his money by renting to special clients. The third floor had all the earmarks of a Nazi safe house.
We're going in. See you up top.
Then he signaled the three men with him and started around the corner toward the fire elevator. They didn't dare activate it because it might be noisy and creak, since the machinery was old. But they could scale the ladders flanking it on either end, and by that means reach the third floor. After that, whatever went down would be a crapshoot that he hoped wouldn't turn into a turkey shoot with him and his men as the targets. The Marine guards lay dead, and Rolf sat at the 12A's controls, the main rotor increasing revolutions. Through his transceiver, Kronberg monitored a garbled mixture of breathing and occasionally intelligible sounds, while his men attacked the motor pool fuel dump, planting demolitions, suppressing resistance. These men not only aided Kronberg's own escape along with Martin, Rolf, and the two other SS men accompanying Kronberg, but they aided their own escape as well. If all went well, the fuel dump explosions would alert base security. Then, if Martin's absence was not already detected, it would be. Someone would realize the Admiral's high-speed helicopter was missing, and all attention would be focused on that. Meanwhile, Kronberg would be getting away in the helicopter, and his men who attacked the fuel dump would escape in the confusion, then dissolve into the Nazi commando units already in place on the island. An unexpected assist to Kronberg's intentions was coming from the heavy volume of air transport takeoffs, wholly unanticipated but entirely welcome. The more crowded the airspace surrounding Pearl Harbor, the more difficult it would be for the naval authorities to scramble a fighter squadron, even given that virtually all fighter aircraft were jump-capable, could take off and land vertically. Young Martin was still shackled.
There is no time now, Martin. You must be patient, I implore you.
Kronberg, despite his rank of Gruppenführer, did not consider himself above the task at which he was currently employed. He assisted two SS men in deploying the helicopter's door gun. It was a PEM-7, the finest in power, range, and accuracy of the light plasma energy cannons in the arsenal of the Transglobal Alliance. The door gun on the other side was being treated similarly by the two men picked up at the gate. Mounting it between the doors as they did, there was a full 360 degrees of possible rotation, allowing them to cover and cross both sides of the helicopter's fuselage. With any luck, they would never need it.
It is my pleasure to report that the aircraft is prepared for takeoff, Herr Gruppenführer. Awaiting your order.
Very well, get us out of here, Roth.
Yes, Herr Gruppenführer.
The aircraft slipped forward and began to rise. In what seemed like a mere instant, the helicopter was airborne, skimming over the Fleet Admiral's headquarters building. Further inland, Kroenberg could see the smoke and glowing bright orange fires from the synth fuel dump against the night sky, where base firefighting equipment was racing toward it. John Rourke drove the borrowed, for official use only, sedan with only the scantest portion of his concentration. The Nazi attack on the school bothered him greatly, not only in its actuality as an act of heartless brutality, but as a symbol of the times. After more than six centuries, what had actually changed? The Earth's population was the merest fraction of what it once was, yet human life was valued more cheaply than ever. When he someday was able to restore Sarah, what sort of a world would he be giving her? As he pressed the button to lower the driver's side electric window, the sirens he'd heard for some time while approaching Pearl Harbor's main gate became suddenly piercingly louder.
I wonder what's going on.
To his right, from the direction of the motor pool, there were explosions, and heavy black smoke rose into the darkness, obscuring the base's artificial lighting. Fire equipment raced along the intersecting street just beyond the main gate. After Dr. Rolvog's briefing on the impending volcanic eruption, they had spent their time discussing with Admiral Wilma Hayes the role the Navy's submarines could play in implementing Rolvog's diversion theory. Rolvog himself left for a quick meal and the gathering up of his gear, then a helicopter ride to the volcanic summit. Admiral Hayes introduced Rourke and his family to various naval personnel and civilians whose expertise might dovetail into the project. Rourke showed his ID and those of the others with him to the sentry computer. And as he did so, one of the shore patrolmen on duty there saluted.
Begging the general's pardon, sir, but I have orders from the commander of Washington to respectfully request the general come to the base brig at once, sir. Where it has been discovered, sir, that the VIP prisoner has escaped, apparently aided by a commando team which has stolen Admiral Hayes' helicopter, sabotaged the motor pool synth fuel dump in order to create a diversion, sir.
Damn it! Martin's free!
Thank you.
Then he took back the proffered IDs for himself, Paul, Michael, Annie, and Natalia, and he stomped the electric car's accelerator pedal to the floor as he threw the cards onto the seat between him and Paul. If Martin escaped them, all hope of forcing Dietrich Zimmer to perform the operation Sarah needed so desperately would vanish with him. John Rourke just missed a fire truck as he took the hard left turn. Information was already coming in that a black prisoner had accompanied the men in dress whites who had boarded and offlifted Admiral Hayes' helicopter. That there was no reason for the murder of the man they found in the cell was obvious. The Nazis had simply done it.
They wanted Martin to look like Seaman Langley, but why this?
John Rourke looked at Commander Washington, then back at the body of Seaman Langley.
He would have been out of the brig and back to duty in another day, for God's sake. What do you do to them?
Langley's throat was slit from ear to ear and his eyes stared glassily toward them across the floor where his body lay beside his bunk.
Not a thing. They just like killing people. Will your shore patrol investigators mind if I close his eyes?
I don't think so.
Rourke nodded only, bent over the man, and closed the man's eyelids.
Rest in peace.
Rourke rose to his full height again. He looked at the others standing there with him, inside and just outside the cell enclosure.
If they've taken Admiral Hayes' helicopter, they're making a run to one of the other islands. And surface vessels large enough for them to land a chopper on would be too easily spotted and neutralized. They may be daring, even reckless, but they're not stupid, our adversaries. So they won't be likely to try ditching in the ocean and making a submarine pickup. And the comparatively few subs that Eden has are small and wouldn't be any match for the United States fleet head-on. If the Nazis are planning on using a submarine to get away, it would have to pick them up after they were safely landed and some time had passed. They'd know that right now we'd have every aircraft and every submarine at our disposal looking for them, and an Eden sub wouldn't make it through the grid. That means that we may have lost custody of Martin Zimmer, but we haven't lost him permanently, or at least not yet. The Admiral's helicopter. Tell me about it, Commander Washington.
Well, it's a fast, very fast machine. It can outfly any chopper in the air and give a good accounting of itself with some types of fixed-wing aircraft. It's that fast at top speed, and it's exceedingly maneuverable. Admiral Hayes uses it when she has to get from Pearl to Midwake. She can land on one of the surface platforms there after just 4 hours. It burns through fuel fast, though, and it's light, so there isn't the weight to spare for a large fuel load. Cruising range is maybe 2,875 miles. I'm no expert on aircraft.
Fine. Now, we assume that the men who took Martin Zimmer will be clever. They'll have planned this phase of their operation as carefully as the rescue itself, right down to the fuel dump fires. They'd want to get out of the air as quickly as possible. I assume the Admiral's chopper can be flown on autopilot like the other helicopters I've encountered in this time?
I guess so. It's checked easily enough.
But in a moment, shall we? Assuming it can fly on its own without a human pilot at the controls, the logical thing for the commando team to do would be to set the machine down quickly in some relatively safe location, then get it airborne again and send it out on remote through the weakest portion of the United States sensor net. But keeping in mind, they have to make it appear that the craft has an actual practical destination. Then they simply blow it up. So we should first confirm that the Admiral's helicopter was carrying its maximum fuel load before it was taken. Then determine maximum range from Pearl, not bothering to deduct the amount of flying time needed to reach one of the other nearby islands, because they could top off the tanks easily enough before the craft goes airborne again. Pick likely landing sites, not that they would really use, but that they'd like us to think they'd use, within range from here. Collate the data in conjunction with a computer analysis to determine the thinnest coverage of the U.S. sensor shield. We should be spotting a blip in that area within a reasonably short period of time and find the wreckage from the helicopter. They'll blow it up, of course, and once that happens, we'll know we're onto their plan. In the meantime, we methodically begin a search of the most likely remote landing spots nearby. Meanwhile, we analyze these possible LZs in light of our suspicion that they'd be waiting for a subsurface pickup once the heat dies down. That should give us a limited number of sites which can be thoroughly searched. We got a chance.
Tim Shaw thumbed back the hammer of the .45. If the Nazis were utilizing audio-triggered silent alarms, they would already be alerted to the tech team's approach. There was nothing to lose with a click either way. For the past several minutes, he'd been listening to the conversation inside the condo. It was in German, and he could not understand it. But once, he heard mention of Sebastian's Reef Country Day School, and he picked out at least three separate times when SS rank was referred to. And he detected the word Juden, which he knew meant Jews, followed by laughter. If there weren't Nazis inside the condo, he'd have a lot of explaining to do. But in his guts, he knew they were. Tim Shaw moved the microphone away from the wall, flipping power off as he removed the earpiece. The bugging device was ultra-compact and slipped easily into the side pocket of his suit coat. Shaw took off his shoes, stuffing them into his raincoat pockets after first transferring the little 3-inch-barreled .38 special revolver to his trouser band. Then he donned the glasses and started moving again as silently as he could. On stockinged feet, he moved along the catwalk, servicing the ladder leading to the escape elevator. The light from the condo's nearest window flowed in a yellow wash over the synth-aluminum treads. Unless these Nazis were living back in the Stone Age, they'd have interrupters laid out. Interrupters were low-frequency laser carrier beams designed to be used with mirrors, establishing a series circuit. When the beam was interrupted by something passing through, the low-charge plasma energy on the carrier beam was unable to reach the next mirror. This momentarily interrupted the power for an alarm circuit, triggering the circuit and activating either one or several of a number of responses: an audible alarm, a flashing light alarm, a computer video warning, etc. Shaw moved ahead, feeling stupid with the glasses over his eyes, and with them it was harder to see here than ever. The glasses were nothing sophisticated, but the guys in robbery encountered them all the time. Merely sunglasses with exceedingly dark lenses, burglars used them to help spot the pale red light of the laser beams. And as Tim Shaw was about to take his next step, he saw a beam and he froze. He drew his foot back. The presence here of interrupters almost clinched it, that the Nazi terrorist unit he saw was the one with the German-speaking persons he'd heard laughing over references to the country day school and to Jews. There was one other important feature of interrupters. They were terrifically expensive. No rich person would be living in a building like this, but the Nazis would have them for perimeter security. Shaw backtracked several paces along the exterior landing. A wind was blowing in across the city from the coast, and it was almost cold here. The wind itself, a mixture of smells of the sea and smells of the city. He turned up the collar of his raincoat as he leaned against the wall. From his raincoat pockets, Shaw took his shoes, putting them down softly on the catwalk, slipping his feet into them. He removed the sunglasses, stuck them into the breast pocket of his suit coat. Then he took his radio from the same pocket where one of the shoes had been.
Listen up. Eddie, rest you guys on both teams. Found interrupters, I can feel it. These are the people we want. Eddie, you and your guys be ready at the front. We're going back in here in about 60 seconds. If you hear guns, it's the bad guys. If it's the wrong condo, I'll be on the radio fast. Out.
His three tac team men were already moving up to join him, had heard the message he'd broadcast, just as the men with his son Ed had heard. There was no need to repeat anything. Shaw looked at his watch, barely able to see its face. He gave up, counting off seconds in his head. There was no way to get past the interrupters, because if they were laid out at all properly, they would be positioned at differing heights, and maybe a burglar going against an undefended target had the time to climb through what amounted to a spiderweb of laser light without touching anything. But armed men going after a group of suspected terrorists, more heavily armed than they, certainly did not. Tim Shaw's rough calculations made it that nearly a minute had passed.
Billy, Mick, get on the other side of the friggin' window and cover while Sam and I go in. Be fast, because you're gonna hit an interrupter beam about 3 steps from now, and they're gonna know we're out here.
And with any luck, they'd head for the front door of the condo and walk right into the rest of the tac team guys that Ed had waiting for them with shotguns and energy weapons. Then surrender, because they knew they were trapped. But there was a better than even chance they'd go down shooting, and Tim Shaw was ready for that too. Shaw pulled his fedora from his head and stuffed it into his raincoat pocket, crushing it, but there was nothing else he could do. Beneath his raincoat, slung cross-body from the right shoulder to the left side of his chest, was a gas mask bag. He took the mask from inside the bag and pulled the mask over his head, popping the cheeks to make it seal.
Go!
Billy and Mick ran the length of the catwalk. As Billy reached the spot where Tim Shaw had seen the interrupter, an alarm began to sound from inside the condo. Shaw, Sam beside him, was already moving. The .45 in his right hand, the .38 special in his left. As they neared the window, Shaw stepped aside, flattening himself against the wall as Sam fired a tear gas grenade from his launcher. Shaw stepped away from the wall, kicking in the rest of the glass. Shaw stepped back, bullets whining past him. Tim Shaw saw a grenade hit the catwalk surface. He reached for it to scoop it up and flip it over into the walkway below them, but Sam shoved him back as Sam reached for it himself. Shaw couldn't react fast enough to stop him. Shaw threw himself through the shattered window opening and into the cloud of gas beyond. Shaw fired the .45 in his right hand and the .38 that was in his left, his eyes trying to pierce the clouds of tear gas for targets. From behind him, he could hear Billy and Mick entering. Shaw stumbled over something, fell to his knees, pushed himself to his feet, and realized that what he'd fallen over was a body. As the night wind blowing in through the shattered window swirled the gas cloud, Shaw could see the condo's front door. It was open.
Mick, hold the position by the window! Sterling, stick with me! Right side!
Shaw reached the doorway, 3 shots left in the .45, the little .38 special with only one.
You shoot, but keep it at an angle. And I roll out and you cover. I'll signal for you. And be careful, and don't fucking shoot me by mistake.
Billy fired a high one into the ceiling of the corridor, and Tim Shaw went through in the same instant. There was gunfire in the stairwell below.
Billy, control the corridor and don't let anybody down after me. I'm gone!
Shaw hit the steps, taking them down two at a time. The tear gas clouds were wispy thin and nearly dissipated. There was an explosion, the energy weapon firing into the stair treads, plasma energy flickering along the handrails. Shaw took a jolt and fell. There was the sound of shotguns from below, then more energy weapons, then shotguns again. Shaw lay across the stair treads, just up from the landing, the right side of his body shaking. A man's form appeared over him and turned the muzzle of the energy rifle toward Tim Shaw's chest. Shaw thrust the emptied revolver into the pocket of his raincoat, took the .45 from his still semi-useless right hand. He clawed his way to a standing position beside the rail. The gas was almost totally dissipated. Shaw's right hand was good enough to rip the mask away from his face. Immediately below him, halfway down the next flight of stairs, one of the Nazis fired his energy rifle into the already fallen body of Jim Thundercloud, one of the tac team guys.
Fuck you!
The ground shook beneath Thorn Rolvog's feet, the mountain's very fabric trembling.
Isn't this more activity than you expected, Professor?
A little bit more, Carl.
When Thorne had last checked seismic readings just moments before leaving the house, a naval escort there to take him to the nearest open field where a helicopter waited, readings had indicated nothing like this. And Rolvag was afraid now, although he said nothing to young Bremen, that the eruption might have gone too far for his diversion theory to have any practical effect, if indeed it could be implemented. The reason Rolvag had waited, taken time to have a quick dinner, etc., was that high observation thermal image photography of the volcano was not yet ready. He had to know which pipes within the volcano had the greatest magma buildup and the greatest potential for violent discharge, then have them mapped to the base of the volcano, which lay beneath the sea. The initial photography had been excellent, but only so far as it went. The aircraft, which was airborne now over the volcano at over 50,000 feet, was utilized for submarine surveillance. Its instruments, with any luck, would accurately map the heat signatures of the major pipes to their base, where the pipe reached the level of the ocean floor. It was at this point that the diversion theory could be tested. Cracks in the shield surrounding the crater were already appearing, brightly glowing yellow-orange lines of liquid fire oozing from between the rocks. Both Rolvag and Bremen carried masks with independent oxygen supplies, but the fumes were not yet so severe as to require them. They were less than a half mile from the summit of the volcanic shield, beyond which lay the crater itself. He was reminded of the ancient Hawaiian superstitions. Kilauea did indeed seem all-powerful, and it was no aspersion on the lack of scientific knowledge of an ancient people to suppose that an angry deity threatened. Thorne Rolvag was worried. He had already determined that they would take measurements from this largest discernible pipe only, then flee. Going on around the shield to take additional measurements would bring him little extra data and could well claim his life and Bremen's. He kept moving. The ground shook exceedingly violently and Rolvag stumbled, catching himself on his left hand. Bremen was either not so quick or not so lucky, falling almost flat. As Rolvag started to stand, he faintly heard the noise of a helicopter. He looked up and saw a machine rising over the artificial horizon of the cone. It was not the naval helicopter which had brought them here and waited now some distance offshore to be called back for pickup. But as they had flown out here, Rolvag, despite his immersion in his own efforts, could not have avoided, even if he had tried, hearing of the theft of Admiral Hayes' helicopter and the rescue from captivity of Martin Zimmer by Nazi commandos.
We have to get up toward the height of the shield, the summit. That helicopter.
What is it? What's wrong, Professor?
Remember what the pilot said, our pilot, that Dr. Rourke had instructed all aircraft in the area to look for signs of the commando unit having landed, that the stolen helicopter might be put on autopilot and flown away as a diversion.
Immediately after the theft of Admiral Hayes' helicopter, all communication frequencies had been altered to guard against Nazi interception.
What if that commando squad landed here with Martin Zimmer? That helicopter looked like it was taking off, not just passing overhead.
By now, ever since the capture of Martin Zimmer, almost everyone on the islands with any sort of official connections knew that Zimmer was not only of strategic value to the United States as a potential bargaining tool in the impending war with Eden, but that Zimmer was John Rourke's only chance to force the infamous Nazi doctor Dietrich Zimmer to perform restorative surgery on John Rourke's wife, Sarah. Without John Rourke's taking him to Admiral Hayes and helping him to present the diversion theory, Thorne Rolvag knew that precious hours, perhaps days, would have been lost in reaching the right ears. If Martin Zimmer were somewhere beyond the height of the volcano shield, Thorne Rolvag could not just calmly go ahead with his measurements and escape to safety. He would have to confirm that Zimmer was or was not here on the volcano, and if Zimmer were there, return the favor to John Rourke by communicating that data.
Look, Carl, you can do these measurements as well as I can. We both know that. I'll stay in radio contact with you, answer any questions you might have, but I'm going up to take a look on the other side of the shield. You've got a gun? Keep it handy.
Thorne Rolvag slung the SP-89 forward on its sling, drawing the bolt rearward and upward, then slapping the bolt handle down out of its notch, letting the bolt fly forward to strip the top round from the magazine. The second magazine was clipped beside and parallel to the first. He had 60 rounds of ammunition. To save on weight, he had left his conventional-sized handgun aboard the aircraft.
All right, I'm going. Be alert. You know as well as I do that one of these cracks could turn into full lava flow at any second.
And then Thorne Rolvag changed direction and started toward the summit of the shield. He started asking himself questions, the principal of which, as he moved through the purpling darkness, was just what would he do if he did see Martin Zimmer and a squad of Nazi commandos? He forced the thoughts from his mind as he quickened his pace.